Hello.
Hi, Dennis. It's Joe Burns again.
Does this sound better?
Oh, sounds much better.
Oh, good.
Oh, it certainly does.
I'd taken my old dog for a walk and planned to be back in plenty of time for this call, and then it's such a beautiful day, he decided to just lay down on the sidewalk. He didn't want to go anywhere.
Do you have time right now? Do you want me to call you back later?
Yeah. I got him, not only got him inside, but I gave him his supper, so he's all
excellent.
Happy.
Oh, that's fantastic. I tell you, I'm really, really pleased you decided to do an interview with me. I really enjoyed your book.
Oh, thank you so much.
Wonderful.
And you're affiliated with, it says Rock School.
Right. It's a radio show and a podcast, and we have about 20 affiliates. So we're on the PRX network. We get around to a few different people.
Oh, excellent.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. The way I do it is you and I just have a conversation, and then I'll go in and cut out with the answers that will fill up an hour, intermix it with Alice Cooper music, and so you and I should just sort of banter back and forth and make your answers as long or as short as you want them to be. I'm fine with either.
Okay, I like the way that sounds. I have done interviews where I assumed that's what they were going to do, and then they decided to broadcast the whole thing, and even my mom couldn't hang in there.
I will tell you that I normally ask at the end of the interview, but since you brought it up, I'll ask. I do like posting the raw audio alongside the completed product. Do you have any problem with me posting the raw audio?
No, not at all.
Okay. Well, let's get started here, and we'll have a conversation, and we'll just sort of let me count it down so I know where I can start editing in 3, 2. On the phone with me, bassist Dennis Dunaway from the Alice Cooper Group. Thank you so much, Dennis. You go by Dennis, you go by Denny, or what?
I go by Dennis. My grandma called me Denny, and that was about it.
That's all that could get away with it. Your book is titled Snakes, Guillotines, Electric Chairs, My Adventures in the Alice Cooper Group. And let me just tell the audience, and I'll compliment you at the same time, this is the perfect rock and roll story. If you wrote this and took it to Hollywood, they'd tell you to get lost because it's too beautiful in that it has every rock and roll trope. Do you know that?
Well, it is the ideal, you know, story of starry-eyed high school kids getting this dream and then pursuing it to, you know, the tippity-top of the glittery rock pile.
Now you start.
And it wouldn't be the first time Hollywood told me to get lost.
I think that's part of their job. It starts right off that you say in fond memory of guitarist Glenn Buxton, and I thought that was wonderful. Tell us about Glenn Buxton.
Glenn was the kid at high school when Alice and I decided that we were going to start a band. We didn't even have any idea what we were going to do in a band. I mean, we didn't know that Alice would be the singer and I would be the bass player, but we were going to do a spoof on the Beatles, and we were going to call ourselves the Earwigs and buy Beatle wigs and wear those and pretend we were from Cesspool, England, and do a show at our high school, which was Cortez High School in Phoenix, Arizona. This was 1964. And the Beatles had just broke big, and we knew we needed somebody that could play guitar so that we could pretend that we were playing and at least have somebody that could play the music for us. So we talked this tough guy from Ohio into being our guitar player, and that was Glenn Buxton, who, when it came to music, he was open for discussion.
Mm-hmm. It also starts right at the beginning with Alice Cooper stating, okay, I admit it, I've always been jealous of Dennis since 1963. That had to make you feel pretty good.
I told Alice that his introduction is so gushy that I thought that now I'm not worthy of myself.
maybe not. Hey, the one thing that, I mean, I did know from writing credits and such that you had a hand in writing some of the biggest hits from the Alice Cooper Band. What I didn't know, I don't know why I thought this, but I thought it would have been Vince Fournier, who, am I saying his last name correctly?
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
Alice says Fournier, the rest of his family says Fournier.
I'm going to go with Fournier. I expected he was the driving force behind all the theatrics, but in reality, you were, if not in partnership with him, you were sort of the driving force to say, if people, I think the quote was, if people want to hear the music, they can listen to their records at home. They want a show.
Yeah, well, it all sprung out of Alice and I becoming friends. I was 15, he was 15 and I was 16 years old, and he was in art class with me, and he was the only person that had a clue who Magritte and Dolly and, you know, all of those guys were. So we became close friends over that. And when we started the band, I had spent my life being known as the artist, you know, my life. I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And but in grade school, a lot of kids didn't even know my real name. They called me the artist. So I did not want to give up art for a band, but I wanted to start a band. And so I decided, you know, let's incorporate artistic ideas into a band. And I don't know, you may have seen that picture of Salvador Dali with like a bucket of water flying through the air and a cat flying through the air and everything suspended.
It's a real picture.
It's a real photograph.
Yeah.
And it wasn't Photoshopped way back then in the 30s. But anyway, that sort of chaotic concept of having unrelated elements in this show, you know, we took the picture and we decided to make a show around it. So, you know, we did a Halloween show at Cortez High in 1964, and we called it The Pit and the Pendulum, and we had giant spider webs, we had a guillotine, we had cobwebs and coffins and everything else. So it started right from the beginning of, you know, and that was so much fun that it kind of kept coming back.
Mm-hmm. So you, as a local group of heroes, really started taking off, and I wanted to sort of compliment you on this one part of the book where you talk about your very first gig where people got up and walked out. That ends the chapter. You turn the page, and it starts, a few years later, we were headliners. You just skipped the whole thing, man. You went from people walking out to we were headliners. What, can you fill some of that in? Did you become instantly headliners, or did it take a few years?
No, it was not overnight, that's for sure. It depended. I mean, if we played in a certain town and we were on a festival, then there'd be thousands of people. You know, and the next night we'd be in a bar with three people. And that would be the owner, the janitor, who was looking at his watch to see when we would be done, you know, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it really was so up and down because our image was controversial. We had a lot of people that didn't like us and didn't give our music a chance because of the image.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a long time for me to finally admit that we had actually made it, because we would play a gigantic show, big success, and then we'd do some more of these where it was questionable. But when we played the Hollywood Bowl, I said, okay, nobody plays a Hollywood Bowl unless they've made it. We've made it.
And that had to be a fantastic feeling, because in the book it starts to go to heck after that, but that had to be a fantastic feeling, because how many people in their life get to stare out at the, you know, the horizon and say, I made it, I did it, I succeeded, and you did.
Yeah, well, you know, fame is a fleeting thing. You know, it's like, okay, we had an incredible show last night, now we have to do it again.
That's
if tonight is a disaster, then that's what they'll be talking about.
I'm sure it would be. I have to ask you about one story in the book that sounds like something every band would think about doing, but you actually went forward and did it. You opened for the Yardbirds, and by opening for the Yardbirds, you played nothing but Yardbirds song. I had to laugh out loud at that. Did that really happen?
Oh, boy, talk about green behind the ears. We were just, you know, teenagers just fresh out of high school. Alice was still in high school. It was 1966. And, I have a photograph of the marquee, the Spiders and the Yardbirds, and September 4th, 1966. I remember because that's my daughter's birthday, even though she wasn't born then, of course.
Right.
But
yeah.
We, you know, this friend of ours, this guy named Mike Fuss, brought a Yardbirds album over. He had sent away to England. He had heard about them and sent away for the album. And he brought it over and put it on the, him and Glenn Buxton. They came over to my parents' house where I lived at the time. And they put on this record and this song, Mister, You're a Better Man Than I. You know, it was kind of dum, 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 dum. You know, and I thought it kind of plodded along, and I'm like, oh, I don't know, what's on the next song? And I go, no, wait a minute, wait till the guitar break, you man. And when the guitar came in, I was sold, lock, stock, and barrel. So we didn't know that much about the Yardbirds. All we knew is they had a hit, I'm a Man. And then they had Shapes of Things, which... this policeman that worked at the local club in Phoenix where we had become, it was a very popular teen club, and we had become the house band and had gotten very popular with our theatrical antics and everything. And so they would bring in like various groups that were on their way up, you know, the Lovin' Spoonful and Bobby Fuller Four and the Righteous Brothers and all kinds of things. And we would open for all of those bands.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we decided that we were going to learn these songs off of this album by this new band called the Yardbirds because they were going to be coming in. And years later, I mean, more recent years, I talked to Jeff Beck about this one-on-one, and Alice told me that he had the same conversation with him more than once.
But what did he say?
I asked him if he remembered that. I asked him, do you remember? He said... I remember it. He said, I wish I could do his British accent, but he said, I remember it. We had never even seen a cactus before, and we're thinking we're going to see cowboys and Indians and everything in Arizona, and we think nobody's going to have a clue who we are, you know, and the opening band does all of our songs.
Did it upset him?
Well, of course, you know, and there were some kids that, that thought that... They were such hardcore Spiders fans, which was the name of our band at that point. We had migrated from a bug called an earwig to a bug called a spider. There was a policeman that worked at the club, and most of the policemen didn't like us because we had long hair. And back then, that was a whole, you know, edgy thing with the cowboys and with the police in Arizona. But this one cop loved the song Shapes of Things.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where he would be on our side as long as we played that song for him. He would point his billy club at Glenn Buxton and say, Shapes. And we had to play it at least once a night to keep him happy. So kids got to know, relate that song to us. And when the Yardbirds played, there were a few of our hardcore fans that thought they were doing our song.
That's great. Had it turned around. Oh, I love it. Hey, you started your answer with this by saying green behind the ears. There was another story in the book. Again, I had to laugh out loud at it. You guys were, I don't know, going to get something to eat or something like that, and you walked past Mercury Records and basically said, hey, let's go in and audition. Oh, come on. Who does that? You have to wait months,
well,
and they have to come see
bold.
You.
We were bold and desperate in a town called Hollywood, and there were 3,000 bands we had heard that had come there to make it big, and there were not that many venues to get a paying gig at. Well, you know, we had a lot of gigs. People made fun of us because of how we looked when we, you know, we dressed full tilt when we walked down the street together, but it's broad daylight. We were walking all the way from Topanga Canyon all the way up to the Capitol Records building because across the street was this wonderful little taco hut that you could feed a family of five and get change from a $5 bill, you know. and it was good. So we would walk all, or as Glenn Buxton would say, we'd hoof it down there and buy Mexican food, but on the way, we'd keep passing Mercury Records, and we're going, you know what? Let's go in. It's hot out here. It's got to be air conditioning in there. Let's go and see if we can get a record deal. You know, just spur of the moment.
Wow.
And we went in, and these guys were in the control room, and there was nothing happening. These guys were just kind of sitting there bored. We're like, you know, we'd like to audition for a record deal. And they're like, well, it's your lucky day, man. The equipment's all in there. Let's hear what you got. We're like, oh, really? You know, and we knew that Talk was recorded there, the mm-hmm. Music Machine.
Right.
And we knew that song. In fact, it was one of our better, more powerful cover songs as the Spiders. So we played Talk and played a couple of other original songs, and they came in and stopped us, and they offered us a deal, except there was one catch.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted the band and not Alice, because they wanted us to back up the guy from the Music Machine.
Isn't that funny?
And we turned that down. We turned it down because, no, we're a band, man.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, that had to be difficult at the time, because the point is to make it, and they just dangled the carrot in front of you. But I think it's great that you stayed true to the band.
We were very loyal to each other, and mm-hmm. and it was also based around an artistic vision that we all shared so strongly, and we had fought so hard to make it happen at that point, even though it hadn't happened yet. It was happening on a certain level, like, you know, we were opening for a lot of great bands, the Doors and Buffalo Springfield and Janis Joplin, all kinds of stuff. We even had to follow Aretha Franklin back in those days.
How nice. How nice. How
not so nice if you're... Oh. I mean, I'm going, whose idea was this? She's incredible.
Wow.
Yeah, we. That was one of the nights where they were lined up for the exits when we came on. but at least I told the guys, I said, well, don't feel disappointed. We can say that Aretha Franklin opened for us.
That's true. You always
but that
can.
That was right when Respect was a big hit for her. So, and the band was so tight, and she was the best. It was amazing. But anyway, so back to Mercury Records. This is just one example of making things happen for you. Okay, if you sit around as a band and wait for an opportunity to come, you're going to be waiting forever. You know, you got to go out there and make opportunities happen.
I think that's
you know,
great.
That one didn't happen, but for every 10 for every one that does happen, there's at least 10 that you put that much work into that falls through. But mm-hmm. but if you don't keep trying, then it'll never happen.
True. But you did get signed. Along comes Frank Zappa's label, and you do get signed.
Yep. We managed to get on the label with Captain Beefheart, Wild Man Fisher, the GTOs. I think there was a band called Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the Mothers of Invention. That was our first real tour.
Right.
We got to tour with the Mothers and open for them. And all of a sudden, all these people that had been making fun of us in L.A., you know, we were kind of the butt of a lot of jokes. But now all of a sudden, oh, wait a minute, with Frank Zappa's stamp of approval, we better give him another chance, you know. And then we ended up opening for the Mothers at the Whiskey-A-Go-Go, which we couldn't even afford to go in to pay to get in to have a beer at the bar mm-hmm. at the time. Huh. And then also right after that, a couple weeks after that, we shared the bill with a brand new group called Led Zeppelin, and we conquered the Whiskey-A-Go-Go. So all of a sudden, people weren't making fun of us so much anymore.
Yeah, I tell you, I said it at the beginning of the interview. This is a complete rock and roll Hollywood story. No one would believe it if you wrote it as fiction. You guys really sat on top. Hey, let me ask you.
Well,
let me ask,
you know, there was a lot of. There was a lot of camaraderie back then between bands. It was starting to get more of a competitive us against them kind of a thing. But, you know, it was us against the world, but the Doors would come over to our house, and Arthur Lee and Paul Rothschild and David Crosby and people like that. So bands stuck together. So you had the feeling that, okay, even though the Doors were big, they still felt like they were a local band, you know. And so you had a lot of this sort of thing where we're all going for it. But when you think of the competition then, you know, you had every great, you know, yet it was following the Beatles and still in the shadow of the Beatles, the Stones, Hendrix, you know, there were so many great bands that that you had to really come up with something different to be able to stand out at all.
Mm-hmm.
So that was our main goal, try to do some things that have never been done before. And
right.
Theatrics was one, but also our music got very avant-garde, and Pretty's for You album, which caught the attention of Frank Zappa, you know, that was very different. There's never been an album like it before or since, I don't think, but
that's what I've
thought anyway.
That's what I thought when I heard that you opened up for Frank Zappa, or when I read that you opened up for Frank Zappa, I thought, that's perfect. You have a visually theatric band followed by a musically theatric band. This is a perfect pair to see in an evening.
And, well, you know, the Mothers did their own kind of theatrics. Like Don Preston on the keyboards, he would do a bit where he would have a beaker with a little dry ice in it, so it would have smoke coming out of it, and he would be playing the organ as like a pretty normal guy, and then he'd drink the potion, and then he'd turn into a Jekyll and Hyde kind of a deal. You know, they did have some theatrics, but they did theatrics completely different, with a different attitude than we did.
Yeah.
Their theatrics were clever and funny. Ours were, we delivered with a very sinister attitude, and mm-hmm. we maintained the attitude strongly. Even though we did things that were as ridiculous as what they were doing, it just came off much differently. And also we had that ambiguity and that androgynous sexual sort of threatening thing going.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing is, the Mothers of Invention, the followers, the hardcore fans, dressed, you know, like freaks. So very colorful, a lot of tie-dye and very bright colors and everything. And so you'd be on stage and you'd look out the audience and you'd think, wow, well, we're not dressed so crazy after all.
Yeah, these are our people. We found them. Yeah.
Yeah, but talk about an education. Watching the Mothers play, they were so impeccably tight, and they would do, I don't think that out of the whole tour I heard them do the same song twice. They would be playing and you would see Frank go over and say something to the next guy, and you'd see him pass it around, and when they got toward the end of the song they were playing, Frank would jump up, and as soon as his feet hit the stage, they'd go into the next song, tempo change and everything, just right into it. And they'd keep barreling through. They'd only have a couple of stops in the middle of their set. And then the next night, it would be all different. They didn't know what the next song was until Frank decided and passed the word around.
God, that's great. That is great.
And yet it was, they must have had a couple of hundred songs down incredibly tight. So we learned a lot. Okay. We're watching and we're going, oh, okay, we got to up our game. And, you know, and Frank was funny. He was, you know, he was the undisputed spokesman at the time, you know, Bob Dylan and John Lennon and Frank Zappa, I think. But one night when they did do a stop in their set, this was, I think, up in the... Somebody, and it was also in for... Zappa followers, you know, to heckle Frank because they would be looking for his clever comeback. Well, I have no idea how he thought of this, but somebody said, "Hey, Frank, you stink." And he had a letter sweater on that night, and he reached in the pocket and pulled out an asparagus, and he said, "So does this asparagus." And he put it back in his pocket, and then they continued. I'm like, I have no idea what that means, but he certainly shut the guy down.
That's beautiful. Oh, that's beautiful. Hey, tell us about this. You know, even the most casual Alice Cooper fan has heard this story, but you told it differently than I know it. Tell us about the chicken incident.
Yeah, it does have a lot of variations, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
I think some of the variations came about in the early days when, you know, after that happened, that was something that we had been doing for a little while. Glenn Buxton would do this thing where he would tap on the strings of the guitar and during this song called Lay Down and Die Goodbye. And that tapping sound reminded me of chickens clucking. So we got this guy named Larry from Detroit to get some chickens, and then we would just have our roadies set them up on the amp during this, when Glenn was doing this this sound on his guitar. And then we were all sworn, if somebody says, "What were the chickens doing up there?" we'll act like, "What chickens?" You know, that we didn't know. Okay, well, this worked out to be a much better idea than we had imagined, because the chickens on stage, while we're rolling tires across the stage and while we're doing all of this chaotic stuff, the chickens were totally oblivious to it. They would just sit there perched on the amp and act as if nothing was happening. So they stayed in the show. They would stay in Glenn Buxton's hotel room, which meant he would come over to the other rooms to use the bathroom, because his bathroom smelled like a chicken coop.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And he named them Larry and Pecker. So So anyway, we would use them in the show that way. And then we did a few smaller venues where Alice would toss them out to the crowd, and then somebody would bring them backstage, and then we'd buy them dinner and stuff. Mm-hmm. And they'd give us our pet chicken back. Well, at the festival, Alice got carried away, and this is one of the things he says that I believe 100%, is that he actually thought the chicken would fly, and he tossed it out, and it kind of floundered down into the crowd, and they fought over it like it was a souvenir, which we didn't plan on, and so the his version of the chicken story was that, well, you know, he talked about all of the people that were in wheelchairs that were in the front of the crowd. Well, that's not who ripped it apart. That was actually a different night. This happened at Varsity Stadium in Canada, which was the rock and roll revival that John Lennon did and recorded. So now when we go to these other venues, all of a sudden fans would have rubber chickens and be holding them up. And but the problem was the Humane Society, the fire marshal, everybody in the world was there to stop us from performing in their town. And we got banned from some towns like Binghamton, New York, because of the chicken. And we didn't know what was going on at first. We were just traveling town to town, and all of a sudden it starts to sink in that this chicken deal turned out to be bring a reputation with us. So what actually happened is we used the chickens. We put them inside a pillowcase, took them to the show, and then the roadie would have it at a certain part of the set, and then Alice would put the chickens on the amp, or he would toss one into the audience. So that's what happened that night. It was planned, but we started telling people that it wasn't planned, that some fan threw it on stage or whatever, just because they would stop us from playing.
Right.
And we didn't use the chicken after that. That was the end of it. We might have used it one more time in Detroit, but we pretty much stopped doing it. The interesting story, though, was in Wisconsin. We were on a flight, and the mayor of the city was there, And he said, Madison, Wisconsin. And he said, I'm the mayor of the city, and I'm so excited to meet all you guys. You know, my daughter is a big fan. In fact, she's coming to the show tonight. We're like, oh, cool, man. We'll put her on the list, and we'll invite her backstage and whatnot. So now we're at the venue. We're all tuned up. The audience is there, ready for a show, and we're ready to go out and play. And all of a sudden, here's the fire marshal, the police chief, the Humane Society, the animal rights people, and everybody saying, you can't play. The show's off. Hmm. We're like, what? They're like, no, you guys can't play in this town. And this was almost miraculous, but the phone on the wall was ringing, and somebody answered it and said, oh, it's the mayor, and he wants to talk to Alice. So Alice gets on the phone. He says, oh, yeah, we're going to invite your daughter back, but, you know, the show's not going to happen. He's like, what? And he told him what was going on, and the mayor had Alice put the police chief on the phone, and that parted the seas like Moses. All of a sudden, we had VIP red carpet treatment for the rest of the night.
You bet. That's the way to go. Hey, on your third album, I think it was, producer Bob Ezra gets into the picture. And, I mean, if you read about rock and roll, Bob Ezra has been so influential in so many bands. Tell me about how Bob Ezra affected the Alice Cooper band.
Now, you see, this is a common misunderstanding. Ezra Music is Shep Gordon's publishing because his middle name is Ezra, mm-hmm. E-Z-R-A. Bob Ezrin is E-Z-R-I-N.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, Bob did, well, you know, the Alice Cooper group was the very first group he ever recorded. And after us, he did Pink Floyd, The Wall. He did Kiss, Peter Gabriel, on and on and on. I mean, you can't even begin to, I mean, he's doing all kinds of stuff to this day. He was the boy wonder. He was he was young, but he looked younger than he actually was. But mm-hmm. He came to Max's, Kansas City, in New York City. And the reason he was there is because we had the whole reputation of the Chicken, and Alice Cooper was talked about, and people knew who we were, but we didn't have a hit single. And when we were driving around the Midwest, we'd be listening to the radio, and the songs that we thought jumped out of the dashboard speaker were the Guess Who. And we wanted the guy that produced the Guess Who to produce us. So our managers were bugging Jack Richardson, who was the producer, to, you know, come and listen to us. And, I mean, if Jack went home, there would be a message. If he went to his hotel, if he is traveling and producing, there would be messages at his hotel, at the recording studio, and everything. And finally, and he had heard, all he knew about the Alice Cooper group was the Chicken, and mm-hmm. that we dressed like girls. That's all he thought. So he talked Bob Ezrin into going to New York City to listen to us so that he could tell us that he listened and they'll pass and stop calling him. And Bob Ezrin came to Max's, Kansas City, and there was hardly anybody there. We had to tune up on the stairwell because the dressing room was full of cases of beer, and we were not happy. We were, for the one time in our entire career, we were talking about not playing. And we decided to play, but we put all of this... we were angry. So we put all this anger into our show, and Bob Ezrin happened to be in the audience. And he came up and he said, I love that song, I'm Edgy. And it probably was pretty edgy that night, but he didn't find out until after he helped us get a Warner Brothers record deal, and he came to our farm to start working on pre-production for the album, that it was actually called I'm 18.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Edgy isn't bad, though, is it?
No, why didn't you write a song called I'm Edgy? That, I think that's great.
Good idea.
Yeah, that would have
worked.
You know,
I did perform it in New York City recently with a punk band, and we did I'm Edgy.
Huh.
A punk version. Yeah, so Bob Ezrin had all of this musical knowledge, classical, piano player, and he brought a whole new awareness of how to arrange a song to us. You know, we would have a song that had 50 changes in it, and he'd say, well, you've got 20 songs there. You just played me 20 songs all connected together. Let's make some songs out of it. Let's pick out these ideas are great. That's a song. These ideas are great. That's a song. And the very first thing we worked on was I'm Edgy. Mm-hmm. We took this long, sprawling version that we did on stage, and he made a concise AM radio hit single out of it.
Did that bother anybody that this song of yours just basically became a pop song?
No, because we had pop sensibility. We were all Beatles fans and whatnot, and we knew that we needed a hit, and we knew that what we were doing wasn't getting that job done. So,
yeah.
No, the only thing is having a foreign person come into our, a stranger come into our rehearsal room, which was sacred territory. You know, we were all very adamant about what we were doing, and we all discussed every single note that anybody played, and it was heated discussions, but it was all sounded heated anyway, but it was all just us all being passionate about what would be the best idea for the song, or that mm-hmm. part of the song even.
Yeah.
And the whole thing was, is he going to come in and start bossing us all around, or is he going to come in and be part of the attitude that we apply on a daily basis? And he came in, the first thing that happened, Glenn Buxton fired off a couple of singers, and a lot of people would have not gotten it and walked out of the room feeling insulted or whatever, but Bob Ezrin stood his ground and even fired back, and we're going, all right, he's in.
I like this guy. Great.
He's in. And yeah. Then the first thing we did, and it only took a couple of hours to make I'm 18 into a hit single. So So he was in.
So now you're a hit, and through the book, you talk about the size of the audiences and the people that come, over 150,000 people in Sao Paulo, Brazil, but you also start to lament that because the band's name is now Alice Cooper, it's so easy to say that one person must be Alice Cooper, and that goes to Vince, and you say that starts to drive a wedge into the band. Could you really see it that hard, and could you tell us about what it did to the band?
Well, it actually happened in, conscientious planning. We decided as a group that it was confusing to a lot of people that Alice Cooper was five guys, and Alice Cooper was the singer as well. We're like, well, what's confusing about that? What about Manfred Mann? Everybody figured that out, you know, so all we have to do is tell them what we want them to know, and that's what they'll know. But we found that it was easier for, you know, it's just, when you think about it, if you get a little picture in the newspaper and it's five guys, it can look like, you know, 50 different groups, you know, but if it's one guy, it can be a bigger picture. And it can be more effective, especially with the eye makeup, which I came up with that idea in New York City for Alice to wear the spidery eye makeup.
Tell us where you got that.
It was the Joffrey Ballet in New York City was made this big poster that was promoting their spring season. And there were four of these giant posters, 7 feet tall and 3 feet wide, on the front of the New York City Center, which is still there. It still looks exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in town, and we used to all share rooms in those days. And I was sharing a room with Alice, and I got in the room, and he started fiddling with the television. I looked out the window and saw these four posters, like two stories down, and said, Alice, come here, look at this. And he looked, but he was more interested in the television, you know. And I'm like, look at the eyes on that clown. It was a clown with this spidery kind of spiky eye makeup. I said, if you wore makeup like that, people in the back row could see you. I mean, you'd stand out. And so Alice was semi-interested, but not really. So when I kept checking out the window, and when I saw a line at the box office, I went down there and stood in line. When I got up to the box office window, I said, hey, can I have one of those posters? And they said, well, no, not until the promotion is over with, but here's... They gave me a couple of smaller ones, so I took it back and showed it to Alice, and he's like, oh, okay, well, so we pooled our money and went down and found some drugstore where we bought some not whiplash, that was a later thing, but eye makeup, eyeliner, and went back to the hotel room, and Alice put it on, and I was watching him, he's looking in the mirror, and he's putting the makeup on, and when he was done, I said, so what do you think? And Alice said, I don't know about for stage, but for every day.
Oh, sure. Yeah, for everyday use, it really works. It really does.
But that was the beginning of it. So that became, and the band all agreed that we should write some songs to help develop this dark character that Alice had done on one song early on, Fields of Regret, on the Pretty for You album. He did different characters for each song, and on Fields of Regret, he did this darker character, and that seemed to be the one thing that really the audience found could relate to. And so we decided, okay, well, we've got to write some songs and develop this character. And So it was, we all agreed on the effort to present Alice as a character. He was going to be both things. It was going to be Alice Cooper, the character, and it was going to be Alice Cooper, the entire group. So it was going to be both. Mm. And so we agreed to do that, and everything was fine and dandy until the more successful we got, the more... we were shoved into the shadows. So that was where the cracks started showing.
Speaking of that, there's a section in the book where you guys are now touring on Billion Dollar Babies. And you had gone on and on about the success and the people. And you said, we were not billionaires. Not only, we weren't even millionaires. And I kind of shook my head at that. And I thought, you're the biggest band in the world. How is it possible you're, I mean, I wanted to ask you this specifically. How is it possible you're that popular, all the tours, the records, the merchandise, and you're not a wealthy young man yet? How is that possible?
Well, also, School's Out was the biggest selling single in the history of Warner Brothers.
There you go.
So that's the question that the group started asking, and the reasoning that we got was that we're sinking all of our money into the show. We're like, well, then maybe we should not do the show so we can make some money.
Right.
And we weren't serious about that because, we were later on painted to have decided that we weren't going to do theatrics anymore and that all we wanted to do is split up the money and just get up there and play our songs, and that wasn't true at all. That just, all we wanted to know is, hey, wait a minute, if we have the biggest selling single in the history of Warner Brothers Records, then how come I can't afford to buy a car?
Yeah, a good question. A real good question. So,
it's not the first time in rock and roll history that sort of scenario has gone down.
Well,
there's a lot of great bands that were in worse situations than we were.
Yeah, but you got to be a rock star. Let me ask you a question that was not in the book. I've heard this from a couple different people, and since it's not in the book, I don't know that it'll make the show. But I just wanted to see if this is true or not. I heard a story that Groucho Marx was invited to one of your shows, and this old man, Groucho Marx, is standing in the back of it, and you guys are rocking out, and he turns to whoever brought him and went, oh, that's good vaudeville. Is there any truth to that?
Well, this is one of Alice's stories, and it probably happened. It probably happened like on the Welcome to My Nightmare tour.
Oh, past
because,
the band.
Because, you know, if it happened to the original group, I don't remember it, and it doesn't seem like something that I would have missed mm-hmm. or forgotten. Definitely wouldn't have forgotten.
Oh, I'll bet
but,
not.
But I can see it. I can see it. We were vaudeville. We had a lot of that kind of shtick going, and so, you know, I find that a believable story.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of people came, you know, it seems like we had this one sort of point where a lot of people that didn't like us, all of a sudden they claimed that they liked us all along, you know, and then other people, celebrities, now all of a sudden were attracted, you know, success attracts all kinds of things, and we started meeting a lot of famous people. I mean, we'd play in France, and Omar Sharif would be there, and Charlie Watts would be there. And,
cool.
We would have dinner with Bianca Jagger and Derek Taylor and stuff like that. So, you know, people want to go wherever success is, and once we became successful, then it opened the door for meeting a lot of celebrities that we otherwise probably wouldn't have met.
Right. Speaking of success, it is so damn impressive. You're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You are in the... Dennis, you're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, you know, people are critical of the Rock Hall because they want their favorite band that hasn't been inducted yet to get in. Well, we went through that for quite a few years. You know, there was over a decade where we were eligible in more ways than one, and in more ways than many of the groups that had been inducted were. But we finally got in, and there's still bands out there that should be in that aren't in yet, and I have a vote now, so I can vote accordingly. But you know, I always say if they inducted everybody that deserves to be inducted tomorrow, what are they going to do next year?
That's true. That's
so
true.
And the Rock Hall, there's two entities. There's the Rock Hall Committee in New York City, and then there's the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum staff, who are just the most wonderful people ever. It's always red carpet, and the Rock Hall is a magical place. They've just redone it. It's all jazzed up now. It was cool before, but it's even cooler now.
Mm-hmm.
And they just opened this new exhibit, pinball machines. So you've got rock and roll pinball machines, Kiss, and even Dolly Parton. I think that's the only female that's represented.
Is there an Alice Cooper pinball machine?
There is, and Ooh. It is loud. The volume on that thing will knock you over. And it's Alice talking to you, and it's quite elaborate. I mean, Alice and I did the presentation recently, and because I loaned them the original electric chair from the Alice Cooper show, the Love It to Death tour,
mm-hmm.
and Alice loaned them his Andy Warhol painting of an electric chair. So him and I both opened the new exhibit. When you buy a ticket there, you get coins, so you can go and actually play these machines.
Oh, you can touch them.
And so Alice played his machine. He was the first person to play his machine, and I was the second person to play it, and my wife Cindy was the third person to play it, and Cindy kind of mopped the floor with both of us. Alice and I were pretty pathetic.
You can't be good at everything, Dennis. Come on.
Yeah. Well, Alice says that he wanted, when they were designing it, he wanted them to put a real shock in there. So if you made a mistake, you would get knocked back about 6 feet. But he said there were some legalities that prevented it.
But a great idea. The name of the book, again, Snakes, Guillotines, or as you said, guillotines, electric chairs, my adventures in the Alice Cooper group. And it is written by Dennis Dunaway, the bassist for the group and the person who was there from the beginning. I'll finish the interview by saying what I did at the beginning. It is literally the perfect rock and roll Hollywood story. And you guys were certainly trailblazers. Dennis, thank you so much for spending an hour of your time with me.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
It was wonderful. And I think people are really going to enjoy it. And they should, if there's any interest simply in the world of rock and roll, buy the book, because I loved it. Absolute cover to cover. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Okay, stay with me. Stay with me.